Do you think doing drugs is cool? Do you think killing small Ukrainian children is cool?
It must be quite apparent by this time to any thinking individual that the people of our country and people of other countries all over the world are coming to face a moment of grave decision. The time when we will choose the course of our future.
Oklahoma, Texas, New York, Philadelphia, around the world, it's gonna be a big nut bus.
The Millennial Media Offensive Podcast is now live.
That's right, you're listening to MMO number 195. Today is November 25th, 2025, and from the great city and state of St. Louis, Missouri, I'm Dan Gehring, and I am alone. There is no John G. Doe. He's off somewhere. I'm sure he'll let us know next week where he was. But it's a shame he couldn't be here with us today on November 25th, which is International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women. You can tell that that is a woman named holiday because it is long, irrationally long, right? Not like National Parfait Day, which today also is. And that is my attempt at a solo show entrance. So happy Turkey Week to everybody. We're here on the offensive by ourselves. We're not live on YouTube, Rumble, or Twitch tonight because I just want to make a short and sweet show. All donations will be pushed to the next show, episode 196. So thank you if you did donate. That being said, I think we should just get into the news. There's a lot going on around the world. A lot of talk about Trump and the Ukraine peace plan that's going on. I brought a clip from CNN where they talk about this peace plan and the peace process that's currently going on. So let's hear about what Donald Trump and the evil Republicans are doing to stop the war in Ukraine.
We do have breaking news out of Ukraine. The country's Air Force says that Russia is launching a ballistic missile attack tonight on Kyiv. This follows a drone strike on Kharkiv yesterday. Even so, both the U.S. and Ukraine say progress is being made on a plan to end the war. President Trump says that something good may be happening following intensive talks in Geneva over the weekend between U.S. and Ukrainian officials. Secretary of State Marco Rubio called meetings productive and meaningful, and Ukrainian President Zelensky is now striking a more optimistic tone.
Diplomatia aktivizowana – це добре.
Diplomacy has been activated, which is good, very good. We expect that the results will be the right steps.
Very good.
The first priority is reliable peace, guaranteed security, respect for our people, respect for everyone who gave their lives defending Ukraine from Russian aggression.
Negotiators are working off the 28-point ceasefire plan that President Trump presented last week, which calls for Ukraine to give up territory, reduce the size of its military, and promise not to join NATO, demands that Russia has made all along. That plan is now being modified, but Vladimir Putin may nix any agreement, and President Trump's initial demand that Ukraine agree to a plan by this Thursday now appears flexible. So there is a lot in flux and much to discuss with Brett McGurk, CNN global affairs analyst who has served in senior positions. Great to see you. Look, you've been on the inside, now from the outside. Can you tell where things are headed? Is this moving away from that very pro-Russia 28-point document?
The 28-point peace plan, I'm going to stop right there. The pro-Russia 28-point document. Because Donald Trump is seemingly the only world leader that wants peace and gave some concessions to Russia, it is now a pro-Russia 28-point plan. That's what they're referencing, the 28-point peace plan that Trump put together from CNN. And it is blanket across all the mainstream media, across multiple segments on CNN, it is known as the Russian document. It's like the Russian law that passed in Georgia, the country of Georgia, the past year. But alas, we'll see if it is moving away from Trump's pro-Russian 28 points.
Yeah, John, I spent some time at that Intercontinental Hotel in Geneva where a lot of deals, many times in secret, are done. I was struck by the room there. You had about 10 people on each side. It's kind of hard to get things done with that group. But look, it looks like there was some progress made. You know, over the weekend, John, this is what makes foreign policy both so interesting and so complicated. It's not just the president. He has primary authority in foreign affairs, but there are other actors, particularly here. And if you even go through that 28-point plan that came out last week, there's a role, John, for Congress, because it calls for lifting sanctions on Russia. Those are congressionally mandated sanctions. You can't do that without Congress. There's a role for Europe. It talks about using frozen funds that are in Europe. Europe has a say in that. There's a role for NATO. NATO has a say. And, of course, Ukraine has a say. So what you saw over the weekend was all these other actors get involved and say, hey, wait a minute. We need some changes to this plan. And then you had the U.S. side meet with the Ukrainians. And from what we are hearing, the plan is now significantly revised. Whether this can stop this horrific war that we all want stopped, that remains to be seen. And
it does remain to be seen. Will it stop? Probably not soon or shortly. But it is interesting. You know, DJT, say what you will about him. I used to be a fan. I'm not so much a fan anymore, but he got people to the table. He got people talking. Whether they have to, you know, bring him through the mud and say it's a pro-Russian plan, that's the mainstream media's agenda. But this has kind of been the only dominating story this week. I've got more stories that are more interesting than that, thankfully. But it's Thanksgiving week. Jake Tapper's been off all week on his show. He's had some replacement hosts. A lot of people are not watching the news at night because they're busy prepping for Thanksgiving. And it's just kind of funny how seemingly the world stopped turning and everyone is less so concerned during this week because the news anchors are not trying to spin everyone up. So I had to dig deep, but I found some pretty interesting stuff. Related to Russia on this front, if you've been listening to the show for the past couple of episodes, and if you have started, and this is your first episode ever listening, I apologize because there's usually two of us. John is not here this evening. But in those past episodes, we've been talking about how the cocaine has been redirected from South America to Europe because Trump is hell-bent on blowing everyone up on a boat in South America because they're bringing drugs. And so cocaine prices in Europe, specifically France, had dropped. But this story from the BBC was kind of interesting, and it has to do with cocaine in the UK and what it's going towards funding. so I thought I would bring it here because there is no John here to protest. It's just Dan, and I'm going to play it. So here's a little intro to the BBC clip about what cocaine purchases in the UK are buying.
Anyone buying cocaine in the UK could be indirectly funding Russian arms factories. That's according to the National Crime Agency here. Investigators have revealed that a money laundering network operating in the UK bought a bank to help support Russia's military efforts and evade Western sanctions. According to the NCA, launderers working for the group are operating at least 28 cities and towns across the UK.
These individuals and groups are moving billions of pounds in and through the UK.
Billions of
pounds.
Now,
a lot of that money is derived from local drugs trades. So that can be something like, you know, buying drugs on a Friday night before going out. And as we step back in the National Crime Agency,
that's the best time to buy.
We can then see a chain of events happening. So that money moves to a courier. That courier converts that money to cryptocurrency. That cryptocurrency is offshored. And this is part of a criminal ecosystem that is doing such large numbers that they've been able to purchase a bank.
Fascinating story with me is our correspondent, Will Vernon. Will, just tell us a little more about what the NCAA is actually saying is going on.
Well, it's a bit of a complicated story, Matthew, but I'll kind of try and simplify it. What the NCAA are saying is that they've established a link between this multi-billion-dollar money laundering network and the Russian state and the Russian arms industry. So this network they uncovered a few years ago, and they've been working to disrupt it and undermine it. As you said, they think that it still operates in 28 towns and cities across the UK. But what they've now discovered is that this cash is basically being funneled into a bank in Kyrgyzstan that is working with another Russian bank that basically acts as a conduit for the Russian arms industry.
Ah, yes. The very educated Englishman had to break it down for us, where effectively the drugs, you know, this is a hard concept for anyone to understand. The money is being filtered through cryptocurrency and offshored through Kyrgyzstan, where it is then going to Russia. So effectively what they're saying is if you're doing drugs in the UK, you're killing Ukrainians by funding the Russian war machine, which is quite a story, you know. I feel like if you buy anything that the government doesn't want you to do, somehow they can link it to some crime. You know, if they make the purchase of this substance illegal. That in and of itself is a crime. But now it's really, really bad because not only is it not a victimless crime, you're pretty much killing Europe. You know, he's not going to stop it. Ukraine is the narrative for Vladimir Putin. So if you're doing coke, that money's going to bomb small Ukrainian children. Way to go, you ravers. So let's hear about the key players and the amounts of money involved behind this. As you heard, a bank was purchased from this illegal drug trade money that's flowing into Russia.
I'll come to the critical players in a moment, but tell me what the NCAA is saying about trying to interrupt the operations from top to bottom.
Well, a couple of days ago, I was actually driving back from a work trip and stopped at a service station, and I saw one of the posters that the NCAA have put up in Russian and in English, basically a message to these couriers saying, we know who you are, we're after you, and we're going to get you. Because they are targeting these couriers that often the NCAA say work for as little as a few hundred pounds. And what they're doing is moving this cash around the country and in and out of the country as well. Because how the scheme works is that illegal businesses, so that could be anything from, as you were saying, a bit of a drug deal on a Friday night, buying illegal vapes, right up to people trafficking and buying and selling of illegal firearms. All that generates a huge amount of cash, dirty cash. And what this network did was basically swaps that cash for crypto. And then the dirty cash, they then run through legitimate businesses to clean it up. And that would then go into the bank in Kyrgyzstan.
Twin final thought then. You talked about the couriers, in a sense, the bottom of the chain. What about the top of the chain, George Rossi? Tell me more about him. And also tell me about, I mean, what are the sums of money we're talking about here?
So the main kind of kingpins, if you like, the people at the top of these networks, one lady called Yekaterina Zhdanova, she's in pretrial detention in France. She's awaiting trial on unrelated financial crimes. And another guy, Georgi Rossi, who's the head of this other TGR, it's called this other part of the scheme. We're not entirely sure where he is at the moment, but he's under Western sanctions. Basically, in terms of the sums, they haven't put a finger on it, but it's understood to be many billions of pounds that are being generated in this scheme, so much so that they were able to purchase this bank in Kyrgyzstan on Christmas Day last year. That bank is working with a Russian bank called PSB, Promsvyazbank. Mm. That is officially designated in Russia as a supporting bank of the defence sector. So the entire military industrial complex in Russia that makes all the drones and bombs and missiles and everything else, that is all either controlled by the Kremlin, state-owned, or very closely linked with the authorities. And Western officials say that Promsvyazbank, PSB, is basically being used as a kind of sanctions evasion hub. So that's the way that the Russian defense sector, the Russian defense industry, use it as a vehicle to evade sanctions and do business with the rest of the world.
Do you think doing drugs is cool? Do you think killing small Ukrainian children is cool? That's what you're doing. Every time you light up that doobie, a Ukrainian dies. This is a PSA from the BBC. So very slow news week this week. Those were two stories, and that one was kind of boring. Luckily, a saving grace, and I had mentioned them on last episode, is this guy named Chris Cappy on YouTube. He does Cappy Army, and he does these really kind of in-depth, fun video. Well, I get when to say fun videos, but they're informationally dense videos. And a lot of times, he focuses on places that he thinks people aren't looking. And so this video that I watched and I've brought tonight, I've clipped up and I've brought, is about the Russian influence in Africa, which is kind of this overlooked continent. He's right on that front. Obviously, everybody here on the offensive is very well versed in Africa, but he goes into depth on why Russia is taking an interest in Africa. A lot of the same kind of geography-based ideas that we've pointed out on this show, along with some historical context here, and I think it helps breed well into what we've been talking about. This past week, I think an additional 250 kids were kidnapped from a Catholic school in Nigeria, allegedly, and I'll add some context as to why I say allegedly after these clips, But I want to play this segment now, and this is really my last segment. Then we'll get into some of the fillers that I've come, because it is Thanksgiving week here in the Americas. But we'll get through this segment first. And so this has to do with Russia in Africa. And again, this is Cappy Army on YouTube. He really goes into depth, but let's get a little bit of an intro into what the Russians are doing in Africa right now.
Holy smokes, you guys, Russia's making its boldest geopolitical gamble in decades, and it's happening right where almost no one is looking.
Except
the Kremlin's deploying mercenaries, airlift units, and intelligence teams across the volatile arc of countries in the Sahel, from Mali to Sudan. But
the Sahel, that's a term people don't know, but you do.
Is now on the other glove, as the expression goes, because they're facing the same exact challenges that Western troops battled for years. Russian forces are fighting against Al-Qaeda militants who are closing in on the capital of Mali, attempting to take it over, and they have a security footprint in Sudan, which is collapsing, and there are reports of genocide occurring there. And so today, we're going to examine three of the reasons why Russia is diverting so much combat power and resources to Africa. Let's find out. A RAND Corporation analysis first spotted Wagner Group operatives working as advisors in the Central African Republic in 2017. In the years that followed, Russian private mercenary companies signed official security contracts with at least six African governments. These deployments had what are called operational spillover, where the fighting bleeds into neighboring countries as refugees cross borders. This spillover creates new opportunities that emerge for even more mercenary outfits to move in. It's a vicious economic cycle of conflict that Sean McFate, a professor at the U.S. National Defense University, calls conflict markets. Conflict markets are regions that, in his words, are rich in natural resources, political rivalries, post-colonial grievances, and are short on rule of law. Another way of saying that is that it's the perfect breeding ground for modern mercenary industrial complex that Big Boss would die for.
Modern mercenary industrial complex. So what's interesting is he talks about the Sahel region and the security agreements that the Wagner Group has supplied. He mentions it in a way where you can almost replace Wagner Group with Blackwater or the Nom del Day, the Nom de Jour of whatever Eric Prince's militant groups out of the U.S. is called. If you'll recall, they're currently in Haiti right now, and Eric Prince, we had that clip probably about 2 months ago, was talking about all of the opportunities that were in Africa. And you heard there was this kind of conflict opportunity happening intra-border, where these military groups, in this case it's the Wagner Group funded by Russia, are going into these countries, and they're able to kind of spin up conflict between these countries and then sign security guarantees with the government to take out various groups. So that's kind of the basic groundwork for what's going on. What I like now is he goes into the kind of the why. Why would Russia or the Wagner Group care about Africa? Why do we care about Africa? We being the West, the United States, yada, yada. And he gets into this in this second.
Now, a lot of people are probably thinking, who cares what happens on the African continent? Let them sort it out themselves. And that's a fair question to ask. Part of the reason I think why Western and Eastern countries have always struggled to step back is because you guessed it, resources. Africa holds a massive share of minerals that power the 21st century economy, including cobalt, copper, and platinum metals that are scattered across the continent. I'm an infantryman, not a geologist, but I know that those are the building blocks for modern life that have made me so soft today. Every electronic vehicle battery, every drone, every smartphone, and every one of those monster data centers being built around the world right now rely on these materials. So from a pragmatic point of view, when instability spreads through Africa, like in Sudan and Mali, it becomes a global problem. From a humanitarian point of view, they would make the case that other countries should try to reduce the suffering there, while others say intervening only makes things worse. And it has, of course, been this way for a long time, because during the Cold War, the Soviet Union quietly built one of their largest military footprints in Africa that most people today have completely forgotten about. As the old European empires collapsed and colonial powers pulled out, Moscow moved in to fill the vacuum and offer a communist-flavored alternative. By the mid-1950s, Soviet advisors were arriving in Egypt, supplying Nasser's army with tanks, MiG fighter jets, and training. In Algeria, they funneled weapons to the National Liberation Front through Egypt and Czechoslovakia during its war of independence from France. That legacy is still visible to this very day. You see it in the AK-47s carried by militias, to the Soviet anti-aircraft guns welded to the back of pickup trucks across the whole continent. Through the 1960s and 70s, Soviet involvement deepened as they went from dipping their toes to dipping their whole body. In Angolia, Moscow poured in thousands of tons of weapons and sent military advisors to back their Marxist government. The Soviets established strong ties with Mozambique, Libya, and Guinea. They basically transformed their infrastructure into logistics hubs for the Red Navy and outposts for KGB intelligence that has its vestigials to this day. Who said making friends in your middle age is difficult? The Soviets were the mysterious new kid that just moved into town and everyone thought were really cool because there were rumors that they'd been arrested before.
I like that last part. That's why I kept it in. The new kid that had been arrested before. So what I thought was interesting is he talks about the vestiges or the, I guess, aspects of that previous Russian culture that you can still witness today in Africa. And he mentions the AK-47, which is obviously one of the most iconic guns that was ever created by Mr. Kalashnikov himself. But if you watch any sort of African war movie, Beasts of No Nation, The Last King of Scotland, Hotel Rwanda even, I think, has a few in it. You always see the AK-47. And so, you know, one assumes that it's just because the AK-47 is so popular and reliable, it gets around. But, you know, obviously it's nice to hear that there's some sort of historical context as to why the AK-47 is so prominent in Africa. I'm pretty sure it's featured on some African flags as well. It, of course, being a Soviet invention or a Russian invention. So that was good. So there's the groundwork of why do people care about Africa? Because they've got resources. Everything from stuff we need for batteries, stuff we need for computers, it's all in the ground in Russia or in Africa. The only difficulty is it's very, very hard to get it out of Africa without any sort of infrastructure development. So there's probably a more grand strategy overall. But for right now, I'm going to let Chris explain to you how this all kind of works, how the having the Wagner Group in Africa, how that benefits Russia, or having any country having a military group, how that benefits Russia.
All of this is important context to know because by the early 1980s, the Soviet Union had built this vast geopolitical network stretching from the Atlantic to the Indian Ocean. In Somalia, they operated one of Africa's longest runways. From there, they moved to the Dalak Islands in the Red Sea, where they had just a massive naval submarine base. On the west coast in Angola, it served as a refueling and repair hub, while Guinea acted as an Atlantic logistics stop. You could think of it this way. Soviet ships could circle all of Africa without ever leaving friendly waters. It was an African cheat code. When the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, all that we just covered pretty much vanished overnight. Russia lost its ports, its bases, and most of its allies in Africa. The once global Soviet Navy had no money or mission left to sustain that reach. For the next three decades, Russia's presence in Africa disappeared. This, of course, is until the rise of the private military companies like Wagner, which have quietly started to try to rebuild Moscow's influence. But the multi-billion dollar geopolitical question is, will it work? So here's how it works for Russia in Africa. Wagner has a front company that owns a gold processing plant in Sudan, for instance. But getting the gold back to Russia is an absolute trip because of international sanctions against them. So U.S. intelligence identified a fleet of Russian cargo planes that smuggle gold from the processing plant through Khartoum and Sudan airports to the UAE. From there, the secret packages get shuffled into an identical plane that flies the illicit gold to Moscow like some kind of Bond villain plot. An investigative research firm that tracks this type of activity, called the Blood Gold Report, estimates Moscow has smuggled some $2.5 billion worth of gold this way since 2022. In the Central African Republic, there are diamonds and oil, of course. In Niger, there is a big supply of uranium for nuclear weapons and power. 9 of the 10 largest cobalt mines in the world are all in the Dominican Republic of Congo, which provides 70% of the world's supply, worth over $2.5 billion a year, which, scientifically speaking, is a lot.
Yeah, scientifically speaking. So basically, the Wagner Group has been exporting gold via plane out of Africa, which, you know, probably isn't uber efficient, but at the same time, a little bit of gold is worth a lot of bit in value. And it does make sense as we watch the current fiats of the world increasingly lose value, the U.S. dollar, the euro, even Russia, Russia's currency and China's currency, all kind of being devalued. Makes sense that you'd want hard assets like gold on hand. However, there is probably a longer term strategy that Russia would seek. And I think this will help us tie into why President Trump was out there a week ago talking about Nigeria, and why we keep hearing about Nigeria in the news. So I'll let him explain the long-term strategy.
In an article written for the Center for European Policy Analysis, Michael Albanese outlines what he believes is Russia's long-term strategy in Africa, saying, quote, Russian operations in Africa are not just about fomenting instability or profiting from resource extraction. They are also part of a long game to make the continent a front in a global confrontation with the West. U.S. officials have warned that Russia may soon begin coordinating its war effort with China in an attempt to open multiple theaters of conflict, forcing the United States and its allies to split their attention, stretch resources, and confront crisis across the globe. If that analysis is correct, if we assume that that's what's happening, Africa is a strategic foothold for dictating the pace of future conflicts. One of the most key reasons that Russia's increasing activity on the continent right now is because of political support. This aspect helps explain a lot of what we're observing. According to the Associated Press, quote, Moscow is also seeking political support or at least neutrality from many of Africa's 54 countries over its invasion of Ukraine. African nations make up one of the largest voting blocs at the United Nations and have been more divided than any other group of General Assembly resolutions criticizing Russia's actions in Ukraine, end quote. So by assisting in helping the key leadership across the Sahel, it paves the way for influence operations that any foreign country may engage in. The perfect example of how it has tangible consequences is back in 2019, Russia-backed candidate won control of the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization thanks to African and Latin American votes, giving Moscow influence over global food security policy just before the Ukraine grain crisis. If you're an ambitious strongman or an aspiring dictator in Africa today, the first thing you're going to go shopping for is a security partner. And for decades, that usually meant bringing in Western militaries for training and counterintelligence and counterterrorism assistance. But Western forces came with all kinds of strings attached, strict rules of combat engagement, and limited authority to operate offensively, relatively speaking. The one major exception, of course, was drone strikes. The United States went absolutely ham with drone strikes across the Sahel.
Across the Sahel. That was under Barack Obama, famously, of course. But the long-term strategy, which he points out, is that Russia and China are trying to gain a foothold in Africa as it's kind of, and please, if you have not done so yet.
Let me ask you to look again at a map.
It's very important that you look at a map or at least understand when we're talking about the Sahel region, we're talking about Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mauritania to some extent. You heard him throw out involvement of Wagner Group in the DRC. That's the Dominican Republic of Congo. That's the country that was fighting Rwanda, one of the wars that Trump has claimed he ended when he quotes the seven wars that he stopped. So keep in mind now that he's laid out this strategy or this idea or this concept that Russia is there for resources, yes, but they're also there to establish a foothold, to reestablish the foothold that they had in Africa prior to the downfall of the Soviet Union. So Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso are in sort of that western part of the head of Africa, northwestern Africa. And I want to play this clip from two clips ago. This is Trump talking about another African nation. And when you hear him mention which African nation, I want you to find it on a map. And also in relation to where the Sahel is.
Christianity is facing an existential threat in Nigeria. Thousands and thousands of Christians are being killed. Radical Islamists are responsible for this mass slaughter. I am hereby making Nigeria a country of particular concern. That's a legal definition. When the Christians or any such group is slaughtered, like is happening in Nigeria, 3,100 versus 4,476 worldwide. What horrible numbers. Something has to be done. I am asking Congressman Riley Moore, together with Chairman Tom Cole and the House Appropriations Committee, to immediately look into this matter and to report back to me. And I mean, like, immediately. The United States cannot stand by while such atrocities are happening in Nigeria and numerous other countries. It's not only Nigeria. It's all over. We stand ready, willing, and able to save our great Christian population around the world. This is not going to happen. The killing of Christians is not going to happen.
Now, since Trump came out, since he came out and said that, and Nigeria came out and denied it, there have been two separate instances where children that have been at school in Nigeria have been kidnapped, allegedly. Allegedly kidnapped. Were children kidnapped? Probably. Has it been happening and not been talked about in the news? Likely. I think that's the case. I think now we're trying to highlight all of these negative things that are happening in Nigeria so people like Eric Prince, people like Blackwater, can get into the boots on the ground in Nigeria and help counter that Wagner influence in Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso, the Sahel region that's in that northern part of Africa. So I think what we're seeing in real time is kind of what we've discussed for a year now. When we looked at that NATO versus BRICS map, Africa had always kind of been striped, and we're seeing kind of the next phase of it where we're going to try to counter the Russian and Chinese influence in China by putting boots on the ground in Nigeria. But first, we have to spin up a reason why we need boots on the ground in Nigeria. Enter the Christians are being killed in Nigeria and the children are being kidnapped in Nigeria. Bumblefug in the chat points out, when you get deployed to Africa, medical gives you about 12 different shots. So if you all of a sudden hear about your deployed friends getting a ton of shots, you might be able to put two and two together. But that really does it for the main content of the show. Again, that was Chris Cappy who put together that huge. I would check him out on YouTube, Cappy Army. I'll probably bring more of his stuff. He does a really good job. You know, he's still got the quick cuts and edits that he does for YouTube, inserts minute-long ads, and makes kind of the one-off comments that were clearly written down and rewritten and scratched out and rehad. So it sounds just right. It's not a live video take at all. But, you know, that's some people's algo. That being said, it is Thanksgiving. So I brought a couple of Thanksgiving-related clips. Before we get into those, though, I do have this clip. And this is really symptomatic of a slow news week, which happens kind of around all of these holiday weeks. The BBC running out of content. There's only so much you can run about Ukraine and Russia and drugs that are funding Russia. You have to fill time somehow. And so they released this little number this week, and I'll let the clip speak for itself. This is a filler before Thanksgiving.
Scientists have traced the origins of kissing, which they say evolved about 21 million years ago, by gathering evidence of different species of primates that kiss each other. Researchers have been able to trace the evolutionary history. Our science correspondent, Victoria Gill, explains.
The kiss. It's such a symbol of love and connection that it's the classic romantic ending. But it's also surprisingly common in the animal kingdom. Chimpanzees, bonobos and orangutans all kiss each other. Even polar bears and wolves seem to smooch. And scientists wanted to study the mouth-to-mouth kiss because it's actually something of a biological puzzle. It has no obvious survival or reproductive benefits.
We were simply just recording whether kissing had been observed at all, ever, in that species. So we just recorded whether it's present or not present. And yeah, we went digging through different YouTube videos, all the literature. Turns out there is very little data on kissing behavior across all animal species. And so one thing we're hoping that this research does is spur future research so that people can start recording more information about any sort of mouth-to-mouth behavior in different animal species.
The new study also suggests that Neanderthals, our ancient human relatives that died out 40,000 years ago, probably kissed too. And there's some evidence that they may even have smooched with modern humans when the two species lived alongside each other. The researchers hope this intimate insight could encourage more scientists to gather data that could finally help solve the evolutionary mystery of why we and many other animals kiss. Victoria Gill, BBC News.
There you go. There you go. Animals kissing. You know, what's probably funny is they had that clip ready to go. They're just waiting for a slow Newsweek to drop it and release it. So that's what England gets around this time of year when the U.S. is kind of sleeping because we got Thanksgiving coming up. And everyone knows Europe just follows the United States news because we are the world. Just kidding. We love you guys. But Australia was having some fun this week. And so a senator has been suspended because a senator wore something she wasn't supposed to wear. The whole story is ironic. So I'll play it and add some color commentary towards the end.
One Nation leader Pauline Hanson a short time ago came into the Senate wearing a burqa. This isn't the first time she's pulled a stunt such as this. She did it back in 2017 as well. The reason? She's trying to introduce a bill to ban burqas and face coverings in Australia. There was an immediate uproar within the Senate. Every senator bar One Nation senators were appalled and disgusted by what she was doing. So they agreed to...
They were appalled and disgusted by what she was doing, which is wearing a burqa.
Suspend her from the Senate, but then she refused. And as a result, as I mentioned there, every senator, bar the One Nation senators, then agreed to suspend the Senate entirely. That means that the Senate is not sitting at the moment. No work is being done until this issue is sorted out. Let's take a listen to the Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, who gave quite an impassioned speech.
So impassioned. She's a lesbian.
Senator Hanson, all of us in this place have a great privilege in coming into this chamber, a great privilege. And we represent, in our states, people of every faith, of all backgrounds, and we should do so decently. And what we should not do in this place, whatever views we may have on policy, is to be this disrespectful of the chamber, and of people of faith, whatever our own beliefs may be, the sort of disrespect that you are engaging in now is not worthy of a member of the Australian Senate.
And outside of the Senate, Australia's special envoy to combat Islamophobia has released a statement saying that veiled Muslim women have long been easy targets for bigotry and intolerance against Muslims. A proposed burqa ban will further stigmatise them as outsiders and embolden harassment and abuse. All women should be free to choose what they wear or do not wear. So we're standing by, Joe, for when the Senate...
All women should be free to choose what they wear and do not wear. And the senator wore a burqa to the Senate, and everyone else that does not want the burqa ban has decided to suspend the Senate because this woman wore a burqa. Come on, Australia. I know you're the land down under, where women do something and men chunda. I can hear the thunder. But what I want to say is that's insane. And millennial bookkeeper, grab your husband and come on back home. We've got board games here. You'll love it. I promise you. I promise you, you'll love it. That place is insane. Okay, it is Thanksgiving week, and what would it be without saying, reminding the American people, Reuters, about their financial woes before Black Friday is upon us? So here's a Black Friday clip from Reuters.
Black Friday crowds are expected to be bigger than ever this year, but their spending may not keep pace. Mm. Retailers strained by tariffs are rolling out...
People are just going to go to the mall to walk around.
...deals this year, making true bargains harder to find for shoppers. The National Retail Federation projects nearly 187 million people will shop in the five-day stretch from Thanksgiving through Cyber Monday. That would be the most ever, and up from about 183 million last year. Retailers have launched early promotions to lock in sales. Walmart's began on November 14th and will run in three phases through December 1st, with Walmart Plus members getting early access. Amazon started its Black Friday deals week on Thursday, while Macy's has opened a dedicated Black Friday portal. Sales in stores and online in November and December are forecast to top $1 trillion for the first time, according to the National Retail Federation. It expects sales growth of about 4%, but that would be down from the nearly 5% rise in sales in 2024. Spending per person is seen falling slightly, and a National Retail Federation poll shows that more consumers than last year say they will wait for Thanksgiving weekend deals. Eric Matisoff, an analytics and data science evangelist at Adobe who works with retailers, says consumers are also looking to pay less of the purchase price up front.
One big increase for growth this year that we're seeing is an increase in usage of buy now, pay later. So we're expecting $2 billion worth of purchases to be made using that type of technology, which shows that consumers are still really excited to make purchases and get value out of the discounts that we're seeing. However, they're looking to figure out ways to make the most of their money and stretch it.
Mm. One analyst who tracks consumer pricing tells Reuters that knowing when the best prices will appear is hard to determine because retailers have started promotions so early this year that those deals may not be available for Black Friday or the items could be out of stock.
Well, that's a fun one. That's why people listen to Reuters for sure. Yeah, so evidently people are trying to make the most of their dollar because in other years they just lit it on fire and smoked it like a joint. Good job, Reuters. Finally, I got a little bit of a story here for Thanksgiving. Martha Stewart evidently has decided the best time to eat Thanksgiving dinner. I actually kind of agree with her. My family has always been at this time. But I will let this lovely local news team that's having way too much fun in the studio tell you exactly what it is.
Martha Stewart weighed in on one of the big decisions that happens Thanksgiving Day. When do you start eating dinner? So what do you think? When should you eat, Test?
Well, I think the best time to eat personally is about 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
2 p.m., okay. Because
it's not Thanksgiving lunch. It's Thanksgiving
2
dinner.
2 p.m., that seems
yeah,
like a
but 2 p.m.
time.
Is not dinner.
Yeah, that's not
no,
lunch
but that,
or dinner.
Then you can take a break and come back and eat the leftovers.
Oh, what you got, Rob?
I don't know. That just seems odd to me. We've always been a dinner family, but having said that, we always break into it early. So, I mean, it always happens more like 4 p.m.
Yeah.
than...
Well, if you're hosting or cooking, then you've already been eating throughout the time.
What about you?
Let's see. I would thank you for asking. I would probably say like 1:30.
Okay.
I want enough time to be able to eat, take a nap.
Yes.
Wake back up.
Right.
Eat again.
Yeah.
And then have dessert.
See, we're at the same table.
Oh, yeah.
Listen to what
too.
Martha Stewart.
No, we're not, Ryan. You are not at my table.
I had to say.
Oh, I think it should be around 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Oh, yeah.
People are hungry and they're starting to circle the kitchen. Yeah.
That's true.
You know, if you have a bunch of guests and you don't want to wait till it's nighttime, you can eat and then watch the big games, you know, and then have more drinks and have fun.
Oh my gosh. Look at those.
Impressive. Yeah.
Yes.
Those anchors are hanging on to her every word. Like, right, Martha. 2 p.m.
2 o'clock.
Isn't it perfect?
Yeah.
It still seems odd to me, but we call it supper time. So,
supper time. He's from South Carolina, people.
South Cackalack.
That's why it doesn't make sense.
I'm going to murder everyone on this panel. Now, I'm a 2 p.m. guy myself, personally. I like eating at 2. My parents are currently in town right now for both the holidays and helping us with the kids. And they're going to stay here through their, christening when they get baptized. So they had Fox News on and I never really watched Fox News in my house, but, Fox News was talking about the cousin walk the other night. And the cousin walk is something, I didn't know it was called the cousin walk, but it's kind of funny because I think every now and then somebody, quite a few people in their life has probably gone on the cousin walk. And that is when you and your cousin go out and take a quick walk to get your appetite up. And you come back in the house with low eyes and a big appetite. So my parents learned about that terminology last night, the cousin walk. So no cousin walks for me this year. Plus, I don't have any cousins. I'm with Elise's family this year. So I will not be going on any cousin walks. But that being said, I did want to take a moment and thank all the people that I am thankful for. I am thankful for my wife, Elise, for birthing the two children that I eventually will be thankful for. Right now, I'm just thankful when they sleep, Lucy and Teddy. I am thankful for John G. Do, for being one of the only people that I know that would agree to do a show with a random stranger and have the, I guess, chutzpah to show up week after week and continue to do the show. And so it kind of became at first like this chicken thing, like who's going to stop showing up first? We're almost 200 episodes in. I think neither of us are going to stop showing up first. It's now a thing that we're due. We do it every Tuesday. It's now become a thing. So I'm thankful for John G. Do. I'm thankful for my in-laws, especially my mother-in-law, who has come over and stayed at our house so many nights just recently to help me get some sleep so I can do my job, which I'm now back at full time. I'm thankful for my father-in-law, who is quite literally a pediatrician. I'm thankful for my mom, who's here holding babies and has been keeping us well stocked up with all of our holiday uniforms. I'm thankful for my dad, who is quite literally on the other side of this wall right now, replacing my toilet in the downstairs. And I'm thankful for all of you, everybody that is here listening on the offensive, everybody that has made this a possibility. About 4 years ago, I had this crazy idea that I wanted to do a show where we talked about the news and we delivered it from a young perspective. And I can't believe that it has become what it has become today. Obviously, there is no John today. That'll change next week. But I'm so, so thankful for you guys. It's unbelievable. If you stick around to post-production, a lot of times right before I sign off, I'll let you guys know, and I'll say that all the time. But I truly am thankful for all of you. It just would not be the offensive without you. Now, you hear the outro music, you're like, wow, that was an incredibly short show. You're correct. When John G. Doo's not here, and when I have not been sleeping very well, it's just hard to produce. There's nothing in the news. Trust me. Everyone, take the week off. Love your family members, even your aunt that you can't stand. And just do it. You never know when somebody that you love is going to go away. You never know when it's the last time you said goodbye or what the last thing you've said to them is. So love them. Put our disagreements away. Put our disagreements away and focus on what you love about each other. I'm thankful for you too, Ned. It's kind of one of those you had to be there in the chat room moments. Yes, it was an incredibly short show. I am incredibly tired. Love you lots, Wolf. I'm thankful for Wolf. Without Wolf, you would be subjected to my GIMP skills. Or John's GIMP skills. Or Krita. I think he uses Krita. I'm thankful for Wolf. Yeah. He is a typical millennial taking that week off. But, you know, we all need our time off. He's traveling, so look for interesting travel stories from next week. I'm looking forward to it, personally. Here's a PSA to everybody. PSA, Palmetto State Armory. running some stellar Black Friday deals. I have a Palmetto State Armory micro dagger, which I have heavily souped up and replaced the trigger, added a little sight to, changed out some internals for the Glock 43X, of which it is cloned to, and now it is quite a deadly 15 plus 1 micro 9, which I'm excited for. But from St. Louis, Missouri, I have been Dan Gehring. This has been the Short Offensive. We'll see you next week, Tuesday, recharged and ready to go. Until then, keep one in the chamber. Keep your finger off the trigger until you're ready to shoot. And when it comes to that fateful moment, if you ever have to, be sure to center of mass and double tap. That's all I can say. MMO, out.